Hello and welcome to the Do One Better podcast in philanthropy, sustainability, and social entrepreneurship. I'm your host, Alberto Ligi from London. Please click that subscribe button and follow us if you're not already doing so, and do leave us a rating and a review. It helps others to find the show as well. Today, it's an absolute pleasure to welcome onto the show Philippa Charles, director of the Garfield Weston Foundation. And Garfield Weston Foundation is one of the UK's largest philanthropic funders, granting out almost £100 million every year. And today we're going to be looking at the work they do, where they work, how they work, what's the team look like, what's the governance look like. Do they accept unsolicited applications? Yes, they do. Do they care about capacity building? Yes. Partnerships? Indeed. Research? Definitely. So that gives you an idea of some of the stuff we're going to be covering today. And without further ado, Philippa, a big heartfelt welcome onto the Do One Better podcast today.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to see you again. Actually, we haven't seen each other in a few years, but we did come across each other when I was at the Duke of Edinburgh's Award. You were still the director of the Garfield Weston Foundation at the time, and I think it was Garth Weston who put us in touch way back when. So it's great to see you again. Tell us a little bit about the foundation.
Oh, well, I think it's an amazing thing. It was started in 1958, so 65 years ago, as we speak today, by Garfield Weston. I guess the clue is in the name. And he did what I think is a pretty extraordinary thing for a family and an individual to do. He put 80% of the value of his company, Whittington Investments, into trust for the benefit of this country. And in so doing, we still have the same structure today, but it has grown significantly. We are a grant maker, as you say, so we receive thousands of applications every year from charities large and small all over the country doing incredible work. And we have the privilege of working with them to help realise their ambitions and their plans. And I do think it's an amazing thing for a family to have done. But when he started the foundation 65 years ago, he wrote this wonderful letter to his children, because he and his wife had 9 children. So we have plenty of Westerns to draw on, which is great. But he wrote this wonderful letter to his children talking about how, you know, he believed that wealth came with real responsibility and that you had to be wise about how you handled it. And that actually the greatest pleasure that can be gained is actually by giving it away, which I think is a wonderful basis that we still use today. I mean, it's not my money, but I think he's absolutely right. It is an enormous privilege supporting a family enterprise. You know, we are family powered. We have a great small team, but it is still a family powered organization. And that, I think, makes it really, really special.
And it is indeed very enjoyable giving away if you can. And doing it well, though, it's a different thing than giving it away. Many people do philanthropy and not necessarily do it well. You guys have a really good track record, great reputation. And even if you look at the listing of those top foundations in the UK, you're ranking very nicely as well. You noted a minute ago that you receive thousands of applications. How do you manage to sift through thousands of applications? I've been there, not easy, but give us a little bit of insight into what that looks like.
Well, I'm not going to lie, we do work hard, but we have, I think, the magic ingredient actually is the family. And I think it is a special thing about a family involvement because they really care about this. So while I never have a problem with any of them turning up to board meetings, they do way more than that because they really, this matters to them. It's part of who they are. So they are the sort of invisible glue, the magic sprinkle, if you like, that provides us a set of resources, if you like, that we can draw on, knowledge, expertise. They're always busily visiting charities, meeting things, going all over the country. Our deputy chair in particular, Sophia Weston, is forever on a train to all parts of the UK, you know, exploring things, listening, learning, sharing that with us. We're doing the same. But I also have another magic ingredient, which is a small but really fantastic team. And they bring very varied experiences, actually, and lots of different knowledge. And in fact, I have deliberately built the team from people with experience of the charitable sector. I come from the commercial side. But what I find former fundraisers in particular are very good at is that due diligence. They know what rocks to look under. probably because they've had to hide things under rocks themselves in the past. So they know what questions to ask. They know where the nuances might be. They understand what they're looking for, but they also have empathy. They also understand how hard it is raising money, how difficult, and that doesn't get any easier, does it? Especially at the moment. And I think, to your point, and thank you for your comment about, you know, how we are perceived, we do work really hard on that. It matters to us, because at the end of the day, people won't always remember the content of a letter we sent them or what we tell them, but they will probably remember how we've actually made them feel. And so while we have to turn down far more organisations than we would ever like, we do try to do it with kindness, courtesy, respect, in the same way we would hope to receive disappointing news. I mean, we all get disappointing news sometimes, don't we? And it's not nice, but how it's done makes a big difference. But that said, we have a clear strategy. It's about excellence, and it's about responding to a clear need. So our trustees are very, I think, open-minded. It's not about them or the foundation imposing a point of view on the world. It's actually about the world being able to explain and persuade what is needed, and they are the experts. Our view is actually those people working in their local communities or with particular groups and communities of people, they understand their issues and the nuances far better than we could. We are not the experts. We want to be well informed, we want to be careful, but we're not the experts. And so we have the flexibility to let people tell us what they need.
I love the empathy and that appreciation of not just the content of the letter, but how it makes someone feel. I think that's really, really important. And there is disappointment in this world. You can't receive thousands of applications for funding and not have somebody walk away a little bit disappointed. But there's something reassuring when you have a grant maker who's empathetic to that and just mindful of how to frame things. You touched on the team. As a former fundraiser myself, love the fact that you think highly of the fundraisers. What's the team look like? What's the size right now? Give us a little bit of an idea of your world in the office.
Yeah, we have a core team. And then I suppose what we could say is we have a kind of extended team of brilliant experts who are also working, supporting the family business, who don't necessarily need to be with us full time. So the core team, as I said, we have our grants team who focus on dealing with queries and inquiries, both at the front line and when they're going out and visiting and meeting organisations. We have a small operations team that makes sure that everything from our database to our processes are as smooth and streamlined as we can get them. I have a horror of bureaucracy, as does the Westcombe family, so we do try and keep things as simple as we possibly can. That's often increasingly hard, but we that's our aim. And then we also have a range of great finance experts, and we share offices with the business. So we also have access to fantastic sort of reception, security, office management, all of those sorts of things, which all matter, but free me up from having to worry about those, because they take care of that beautifully, which allows the team to focus exclusively on what we hope is good grant making and some of the innovative stuff we do as well, the partnerships we have.
Got you. And you touched on the business just very briefly for our audience. Who's the business? Give us a little bit of an overview on them.
So the foundation owns 80% of a holding company called Whittington Investments. That's the family business that I mentioned that Garfield Weston owned. So we own 80% of that. And that holding company has a very broad range of investments within that, the largest of which is Associated British Foods. People may or may not have heard of it. It is a FTSE 30 business. It's a PLC, so they may even have shares themselves. But they will probably have heard of some of the brands that sit within that. Things like Twinings, Silver Spoon, Kingsmill, Primark, Ryvita, Ovaltine. I mean, the list goes on. So loads of fantastic brands within that group. But we also own a range of other businesses, from property and right through to other retail. You may have heard of Fortnum & Mason, for example, that wonderful store on Piccadilly, which also has other outposts. So our ability to make grants is down to the hard work of people in those organisations who as they make their money and the dividends come through to Whittington Investments, they then are passed through to the foundation. So the foundation has a very simple aim to spend our income every year.
What a privileged position to be in, because those brands are, they're as good as they get. And you're just listing numerous brands without any difficulty. And I'm sure if we had more time, you could list.
Well, before I came to run the foundation, I used to work in Associated British Foods. So I suppose I have the fortune of really actually understanding where our money comes from and how it's made, and knowing many of the brilliant people who work hard to make that happen. And I loved it. There's something wonderful about manufacturing where you make a real product.
Indeed there is. Now, you touched very briefly on the strategy, and I'd love to delve into that and get a better feel for things. We covered a little bit about the executive team, but tell me about the family and the board, and not getting into the nitty-gritty, as it were, but one bit that's really interesting in philanthropy is this whole next generation thinking. And you have intergenerational component in the governance of the foundation. What's the dynamic between generations, as it were?
Firstly, I think it's extraordinary. I mean, we have nine family members on our board, and they seem to manage a very extraordinary blend of bringing in very different experiences and views and knowledge. So they don't always agree, but they manage to do so in a very productive way, which I take my hat off to, because I'm not sure every family could manage that. I think a lot of that is down to their shared endeavor. They are all united in pursuit of a common goal to do good, and I think that helps a long way to enabling them to work by consensus. At the moment, we have all third generation on the board, so they are all either siblings, cousins, what have you, and they are all, I suppose, at the peak, what you call the peak of their knowledge and experience. Really, they're all in their sort of from late 40s, very early 60s. So they're kind of energetic, healthy, knowledgeable, experienced, all the things that you would want from a good board. And they care passionately about it, and they're forever going out and learning and exploring. So it works. But of course, you're right. We are starting to look at how things might work for future generations. No conclusions as yet, because I think this is something that, one does thoughtfully and carefully. But all I can say is that it's quite remarkable. It works. And it's a very powerful thing, because we have such an engaged board.
That's great. And so the areas where you focus on thematically, geographically, love to find out about that. The grants that you make, would love to find out what that might look like. Multi-year, single year, big, small, restricted, unrestricted.
So given that our strategy is one of about being responsive, flexible, but also about excellence, as you rightly said earlier, there is an awful lot we can't do, and we have to find, nice ways to decline people. But in that, there is a lot of scope. So we do everything from project work, capital, and core costs. In fact, core costs for us, we've been doing since the beginning. It seems to be a part of a very big discussion in the voluntary sector at the moment. But for us, it's business as usual and always has been, which I think is powerful. And we hear consistently that it is really valued. We did a survey last year. We had 1,300 responses from charities all over the country. It was a really, really helpful look in the mirror moment to make sure that, we are keeping our ears attuned to what people need. And one of the really very heartening themes that came back was people really appreciate the flexibility and the ability to apply for core costs, particularly for smaller organisations. But our strategy does allow for other approaches too. So while we are, open, people can apply to us. They don't have to know us. They don't have to have met any of us before or had a grant in the past. But that doesn't mean that we don't take other approaches too. So for example, where we see gaps, we might well proactively work with a partner organisation to create something that does address that gap. So a simple example would be when we ran our anniversary fund back in 2018, and we were giving money for capital for community facilities all over the country. one of the really clear learnings that came out of that was that when voluntary groups come together and they want to, let's say, rebuild their community hall, that is a big project for people. It's quite scary. They don't always know what's needed, what the regulations might be. And these are often people who may not be property experts. You know, they are doing this for the community and for the good of their neighbours, not necessarily because it's their personal expertise. So we worked with the Ethical Property Foundation, who have created a manual. It's an online resource, free to anyone to use, but it goes through step by step in a really practical way how you would go about doing something like that, what you need to think about, what kind of order you might need to do things in. And that's now free and available to anybody. So that's one example. Another example might be our partnership with Pilot Light, who provide pro bono support from business experts to help charities, you know, improve their strategy, to deal with their governance, help prioritize their activities. There's a whole raft of challenges charities face at any given point. And sometimes having an independent business expert or a small team of them come in and be almost like non-executive directors for a period of time to actually help guide and advise makes a huge difference. And back in, well, it's over 10 years ago now, actually, we noticed that the Northeast area, the Northeast region wasn't applying to us as often or as much as we thought that we should, or they should be. We certainly were aware.
Northeast of the UK, just to
highlight. Exactly. Yes. Exactly. So we conducted some research first. We wanted to make sure we understood what problem it was we might be trying to solve. And the outcome of that research was a very clear picture of the fact that charities would want to apply if they could, but they were so busy head down, tail up, delivering, working hard, that they didn't have time to step back and work strategically with their boards to think about where they might be able to maximize their time and their knowledge. So we went to Pilot Light, who we already had a relationship with, who were already doing this sort of work, but on a smaller scale at the time, and said, if we partner with you and put some money behind this as well, can we craft something together that uses your skills and our resources to help the Northeast to start with address that problem? We did that 10 years ago. It worked. We evaluated it, and we have been expanding it ever since. 10 years later, it's still going strong, and it's now across the whole of the north of the country, the Midlands and Wales as well. And there's an annual cycle for that. So again, we're very proud of, I think it's not really then about us at all. It's about the partnerships we have and finding the real experts who know how to do certain things. We are not into reinventing the wheel. If somebody's doing a great job, why would we not work with them?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's great you take it, you encourage unsolicited applications, because not everybody does. And I think, if you don't encourage unsolicited applications, then you rely necessarily on your own internal scouting abilities, which will have a blind spot here or there. What about thematically speaking? What are some of the criteria that you think, look, if you're going to send us something, if you're interested in funding, you need to be in the UK. Do people need to be within specific thematic areas, or is that the main thing, that they're in the UK and that's fine?
Yeah, this flexibility and responsiveness really is at the heart of everything we do. So we don't predetermine where the money goes each year, in the sense that we're not going to sit there at the beginning of the year and the trustees say, we're going to put X amount into education and Y amount into community work. What it is about excellence, which gives us the flexibility. If we saw a particularly significant number of applications from one area that were really, really good and the trustees wanted to support, we're not hampered in being able to respond to that because we have an open enough approach to allow that. That said, an awful lot of great applications, frankly, are across several areas anyway, and that's not a problem. You know, you may well be a really great youth organisation that's working in schools or in partnership with schools. And you might even be working multi-generationally, at which point you're looking at kind of welfare issues or the elderly. So we're not obsessed with ticking boxes. I think that's the important thing. It is about, where's the need? Are you the right people to address that need? Do you have a sensible plan? Do the numbers stack up? Are you viable as an organization? Is your leadership stable? All the kind of sensible questions anyone would ask. We try not to make this too complicated, and our guidance does it gets good feedback, but I think that's because it's been written not just for volunteers, but informed by them. The feedback and questions we get constantly cause us to improve how we convey things. If we're constantly getting the same question, we know we haven't explained ourselves properly. So we go back and we revisit it and we try and refine it and improve it. And my aim really, and that of the team, is to make sure that, every day we're open, we're better than the day before.
You use the word partnership more than once. What's your take on partnership, both in terms of the foundation with its partners, but also perhaps partnerships and collaborations that may exist within your grantees, because you're handing out a lot of grants, and if it's within a specific sector, people know each other, people collaborate. So give us a little bit of take of what partnership means.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's a big word, actually, that covers lots of things, doesn't it? I mean, I think at its heart, the reason we use the word partnership is that although you use the word grantees, for us, it's not just a simple here's some money relationship. We as an organization could not achieve anything without those incredible charities who are delivering on the ground. So in that sense alone, I think it's about acknowledging and respecting the fact that there's a symbiotic relationship. We cannot exist quite often without each other. So I guess I look at partnership in its broadest possible way. Then, of course, there are the partners we have who are delivering stuff that we have worked with them to create. And that could be the ones I've mentioned. It could be with, for example, the Media Trust, where we created the Western Communicating Climate Programme, because, again, we'd had some research done and we could see that actually environmental charities were really struggling to get their messages across. So why would we create something new when actually the Media Trust already has a huge number of brilliant experts who can help that? So, there are times where we have that closeness because we created something together, and then they're the best people to run it. And we can stay in touch with them and we support them and we'll help market it and we'll let our applicants know that these things are available. But they are the ones delivering, and we're very grateful for that. And then, as you say, there are partnerships within the charitable organisations that we support, and we encourage that where it makes sense. Again, for us, it's about being as efficient and effective as possible, and not duplicating seems like a really good start. So if two organisations can complement each other well, then why wouldn't we encourage that in the same way that we do that ourselves?
Yeah. The research you alluded to, and you'd mentioned research before as well, do you commission a lot of research? Do you do it in-house? Do you use external consultants? What is that?
It's a bit of both, but generally we'll use external partners, because research to do it well, I think, is actually quite a complex issue. And those organizations that do it well tend to have, the technology that sits behind it and all the kind of good ways of tracking and then filtering the huge amount of data that comes back. And we pick, again, the people we work with, depending on the issues we're looking at, or maybe the region of the country we're looking at. So, again, it's about finding the right partner. It's the square peg for the square hole that we're looking for. And again, do we do it a lot? No, we do it when we think we need to. Because, again, we're busy every day responding to people coming to us. But where we spot themes or anomalies or things that just cause us to question what's behind what we're seeing, it makes sense to check our facts before we create a new partnership or develop a program or start something new.
A bit of an unfair question here, but what are you most excited about right now? And, we're embarking on 2024. Is there some specific initiative or grant application lurking that you think, this thing, it's going to be really cool? For 2024, perhaps for 2025 or the next 3-year cycle, whatever it might be. But is there something in particular? And that's like asking you to pick a favorite child, but
Yeah, you're right. It's a really unfair question, isn't it? And it is almost unanswerable because there are so many brilliant examples. But maybe if I give you two that are very different. One of them is actually a pledge we've made because it's not yet in existence, but many of the people listening to the podcast will will know about or have heard of the Eden Project down in Cornwall. They may have visited, amazing place. And along with being an amazing place, when it was originally developed 20 odd years ago, it really regenerated an area that needed some support and some help. It created jobs, volunteering opportunities, the ability to learn. It's created a reason for people to go there, whether that's tourists, people on holiday, or school groups, etc. And what is very exciting is the team behind that are now have developed a plan to do something not dissimilar in Morecambe, right on the bay, an absolutely beautiful part of the Northwest, and characterised, I think, by a community that's incredibly proud of their beautiful region and their community. But I think it would be fair to say, I hope they would agree, that economically that area could use some help. And to create a really high quality, beautiful destination where people can go and learn about the natural world and our environment, be drawn there. Hopefully they'll stay the night, they'll need to eat, they'll want coffee. You know, that hopefully will have all kinds of ancillary benefits for schools, for communities, for businesses, for learning. So I confess, yeah, we are all very excited about that. It's in its early stages. And again, you talk about partnerships. The Eden Project team have not done this in isolation. They have partnerships with Lancaster University, with the local council, with schools. This has been developed very much as a, you know, a shared enterprise and something they're all rightly proud of. There's a long way to go yet. I'm not advertising something that's not yet there, but I guess what I'm excited about is the privilege that the foundation has sometimes to be in things at a very early stage and give it a bit of a boost. Our trustees have pledged 10 million for this project, which was a very big decision, one they didn't take lightly, but they were also very excited and proud to be able to make. So that one I'm really excited about. And perhaps if I give an example next door, again in Morecambe, there's a lovely charity called More Music, and they blend community work with music, which is obviously something that can very happily bring people together. But they work with all sections of the community. They have dementia groups and elderly people coming in to give them, you know, purpose and something to do with their day, social interaction. You know, this isn't just about music, even though that's the core of it. This is also about the connections we have between people, and helping a community thrive and bringing people of all ages together. And that is a great organization. They have had a cash grant. They've got a current grant with us. They needed the money today. And again, really excited about what they are doing with the community. And there are countless examples of those all over the country.
Fascinating. Well, it's great that I ask you for just one example. You're giving me two exciting initiatives that you're looking forward to. Your journey thus far, you touched on the fact that you were on the corporate side before. Were you getting equally as excited in the corporate world as you're getting now in the philanthropic space?
Well, the funny thing is, it sounds as though my worlds have been very different, but actually my role in business was in some ways very similar. It was about supporting individuals and teams to be successful. So that was through succession planning, through leadership development, through coaching, those sorts of things. Well, actually, what are we doing now? We're helping organizations be successful. So there is actually a much stronger theme and thread to my personal career than perhaps might appear at first sight. So I guess that's why I can be equally excited about both, because it's about seeing people and organizations thrive. And that's pretty magic.
Mm-hmm. And it's good you're highlighting that common denominator or similarities between these two, because I think for those listening, not everybody holds the corporate space with high esteem. But in actual fact, the corporate space can be an incredible force for good. And as we tackle the Sustainable Development Goals, as we approach 2030, it's nice to see that you can work in the for-profit space as well and actually be feeling very rewarded and motivated about what you're doing, which is a good thing.
I think the corporate and the voluntary space have far more in common than they have that's different, actually. I think perhaps that gets forgotten. And I think the idea that business can be a huge force for good is incredibly true and powerful. And obviously, I've experienced that personally from moving from Associated British Foods, which is a brilliant business to work with. But their funding, they are predominantly owned by us as a charity. So, their focus is to do a great job and also to make money. Ours is to make sure that that is very thoughtfully shared with the communities that need us. So, again, there's that symbiotic relationship.
Yeah. And by the way, that dynamic where you, as the philanthropic outfit, as it were, really owns the corporate thing. Normally, it's the other way around. Normally, you have a corporate and then they set up a corporate foundation. But it's nice to see. I remember speaking with Per Hegenes when he was at the IKEA Foundation, and they have a similar thing. He's like, yeah, they
Well,
don't tell us what to do.
there's a reason it matters for us, and that's because with the business predominantly having a long-term shareholder, we are here for the long term. We don't have to be buffeted by, the more short-term temporary demands of the world today, which allows us to invest and to grow. So, the first year the foundation began, it gave just over 50,000. Now we're nudging 100 million each year. And that's a pretty extraordinary thing. And I guess that long-term piece, just to make that real, since the foundation began, we've given over 1.5 billion. But actually, in 65 years, over half of that has been given in the last 10 years alone. So what that says is the trajectory of growth has been really healthy, but that is because you've got that long-term symbiotic relationship, and that matters. That really is something we're proud of. It's different. Not everyone quite understands that, but I think once you explain it, they think, oh, it really works, and we can show that it works.
You should be proud of that. Before you run off, I'd love to ask you for a key takeaway. What's that one thing that you'd love for the audience to keep in mind after they finish listening to today's episode? If there is one, it could be two.
Yeah, I think the key one is, and we see this every day, it's the power of really great volunteering, because that underpins most of the organizations we support. They still need funding, but a lot of it is powered by volunteers. So I think if my message was anything, it would be whatever skill you have, and it may be strategy, it may be finance, or it may be you're really good at putting shelves up and painting. It doesn't really matter what you're good at. There will be an organization near you that would really value that support. So do something you love. It brings you together with people, it's fun, and worth doing.
Hear, hear. Philippa, thank you so very much for joining me and joining us on the Do One Better podcast today. It's been an absolute pleasure hosting you on the show today and seeing you again after all of these years, which is it's delightful. So thanks.
Thanks, Alberto. Great to see you.
Perfect. And that's a wrap. Thanks very much for tuning in. As always, you've been listening to a great chat with Philippa Charles, director of the Garfield Weston Foundation. For information about this conversation and more than 250 other interviews and case studies with remarkable thought leaders in philanthropy, sustainability, and social entrepreneurship, just visit our website at lidji.org. That's lidji.org. Please click that subscribe button and follow us if you're not already doing so. And I'll catch you this coming Monday.